Welcome to this RCGP podcast about the complications of shingles. The development of this podcast has been supported by funding from GSK, but the content has been independently developed by the RCGP's e-learning team. It is also accompanied by a screencast and a 30-minute module on shingles. I'm Dr. Emma Nash, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Laura Patterson, who is a GP with an interest in primary care education. Thank you for joining us today, Laura.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Emma. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So let's get started. What are the common complications of shingles?
So for most patients, shingles is self-limiting, but there are a few complications that we need to look out for. They may be localized infection or pain in the acute phase, or complications such as meningitis, encephalitis, transverse myelitis, disseminated shingles, or even ophthalmic complications. And the central nervous system complications tend to be quite rare. The most common long-term complication, of course, that we see is definitely post-herpetic neuralgia, which affects about 5 to 15% of those with shingles. And there are two definitions of that to be found in the literature. Either it's defined as pain occurring after 4 weeks or pain occurring after 3 months.
So, what are the most common or serious complications that occur with acute infection?
So pain is common in the acute phase when the rash develops. And for most patients, it will settle with simple measures such as paracetamol or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And the other common complication I think we're all familiar with in primary care is secondary skin infection. So generally from staphylococcal or streptococcal bacteria. And they will present with the obvious signs of infection, such as swelling or redness of the affected area, which may be hot and tender, and the lesions may become pustular. And of course, it may develop into cellulitis or even sepsis. The serious complications are much less common, and we tend to be less familiar with these, I think. There are several that we need to be aware of. Shingles infection can cause meningitis and encephalitis, and the exact mechanism for this is not entirely clear, but it's thought this may be caused by vasculitis. This is more likely to occur in the elderly and the immunosuppressed. Meningitis, I think we're all familiar with, has lots of similar features to encephalitis, but they sometimes can be difficult to distinguish. However, I think it's certain that patients presenting with either of those will need urgent hospital admission. They'll both typically have fever, headache, nausea, or vomiting. Meningitis symptoms also include irritability, photophobia, and drowsiness. In contrast, encephalitis symptoms include altered mental state, confusion, and seizures. Another complication is transverse myelitis, and this affects the same spinal cord segment as the rash and can cause motor and sensory disturbance, so weakness and sensory symptoms, all below the level of the dermatome affected, and of course may include bladder and bowel symptoms. Transverse myelitis has many causes, of which shingles is just one of them. We may see disseminated zoster, where the rash becomes more widespread. And that's defined as more than 20 lesions outside of the affected dermatome or adjacent dermatomes. And disseminated zoster may cover a really wide area and may cross the midline of the body. In disseminated zoster, there may also be visceral involvement, leading to complications such as pneumonia or hepatitis. And this mainly, again, affects patients who are immunocompromised.
There's quite a lot of potential complications there. What do GPs need to do to prevent these?
I think the important part of our role in primary care is to make sure that we treat early in the first 72 hours, if possible, with antivirals for those that will benefit. However, in those who are immunocompromised, for example, somebody with an active cancer, undergoing cancer treatment, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or those taking immunosuppressant drugs, antivirals can be started any time in the first 7 days from the rash starting or any time before full crusting begins. And the rationale for the antiviral treatment is to shorten the duration of the viral replication and shedding. And in turn, this stops the formation of new lesions, reduces the severity of pain, and reduces the incidence of post-herpetic neuralgia. Antivirals are quite well tolerated, but just remember the need to consider a dose adjustment in those with renal disease. And then in terms of more serious complications, We need to provide a really good safety net to our patients just to make sure they understand that they can return if they're more unwell or develop new or unusual symptoms. And just letting them know that the symptoms to look out for include fever, headache, vomiting, altered consciousness or mental state, weakness or sensory symptoms in the arms or legs. So these symptoms should prompt urgent review.
So, what about longer term complications?
So for longer term complications, we see skin changes such as scarring, hypopigmentation or keloid formation once the rash is healed. And in darker skin, we may see hyperpigmentation. The most common long-term complication of shingles is postherpetic neuralgia. At present, we don't fully understand the mechanism of how the neuronal damage occurs. The postherpetic pain occurs in the area of the healed rash and can last for 6 months or longer. Patients describe the pain as throbbing, burning, shooting, and it can be very debilitating, especially for those who are elderly. They can also have symptoms of allodynia, where the pain is caused by a stimulus that normally does not cause pain. So for these patients, they can get intense pain, sometimes just by the touch of light clothing on the skin. And there are some factors associated with the development of postherpetic neuralgia. And these include greater severity of pain with the initial rash, greater severity of the rash, being elderly and also immunocompromised patients, and also those who have restricted activities of daily living prior to the shingles occurring. Prodromal pain, being female and having diabetes, and the presence of shingles ophthalmicus is also thought to play a role. Postherpetic neuralgia can be really difficult to treat and is responsible for most of the long-term disease burden associated with shingles. Postherpetic neuralgia can lead to sleep disturbance, depression, weight loss, chronic fatigue, and inability to form daily activities. And occasionally, the pain may extend beyond the involved dermatome.
So obviously, postherpetic neuralgia is quite a significant problem. What approach would you recommend for this?
So I think the aim of treatment is to improve quality of life by reducing pain and promoting increased participation in all aspects of daily living and a healthier lifestyle. The drug treatments for neuropathic pain differ from traditional pain management, so it's really important that we remember to involve patients in the discussions so that they can make an informed choice. We can offer a choice of medication to patients, and the choice may depend on individual circumstances. Typically, we can consider antidepressants such as amitriptyline, duloxetine, and some of the others, or anticonvulsants such as gabapentin or pregabalin. And then, if the initial choice does not work or it's not tolerated, we can offer an alternative. Opioids are sometimes used where necessary. However, there's much less evidence for opioid effectiveness in postherpetic neuralgia, and there is concern about potential for dependence. Don't forget capsaicin cream for people with localized neuropathic pain who wish to avoid or who cannot tolerate the oral treatments. It is licensed for postherpetic neuralgia, but just remember the skin lesions need to have healed first. And you probably remember it's derived from chili peppers, and it's thought the capsaicin is absorbed by the nerve cells and transported all the way up to the spinal cord, and that this decreases the amount of pain-transmitting chemical that is sent on to the brain. So it takes some time for the drug to move to the spinal cord. So therefore, we recommend that you apply the cream for at least 6 to 8 weeks before deciding to give up if it appears not to be working. If you're getting pain relief from it, you can carry on applying as long as it's needed. And then you're probably familiar also with topical lidocaine patches, and these may be helpful for some individuals. However, certainly in our local area, these are secondary care prescriptions only. Remember, the patches are worn for up to 12 hours, and then there needs to be a 12-hour patch-free interval. And we need to just review at 2 to 4 weeks if there's been no response. And if that's the case, they should be discontinued. So if postherpetic neuralgia is not responsive to these first-line approaches in primary care, these patients will often benefit from a referral to a secondary pain service and a multidisciplinary team approach. However, don't forget your other primary care clinicians. You may have a pharmacist with an interest in chronic pain and pain management. Consider your well-being team to encourage goal setting and healthier lifestyle as well, because these can all help with the management, and contribute to promoting well-being.
Are there any groups who are particularly vulnerable to complications of shingles that we should be mindful of?
Yeah, definitely. There are several groups of patients who are particularly vulnerable to the complications of shingles. Those who are immunocompromised for whatever reason are at greater risk of complications, whether they be immunocompromised through disease, malignancy, HIV, or through medications such as high-dose steroids, chemotherapy, or immunosuppressant drugs such as biologics or DMARDs. An advancing age also increases the risk of complications. There are several other groups who are more susceptible, particularly to post-herpetic neuralgia. And those who have diabetes appear to be more at risk. Most of the evidence is for type 2 diabetes, but there's some evidence for type 1 as well. And the other groups to just remember are those with autoimmune conditions, asthma, COPD, and those who smoke.
Thank you, Laura. I think that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to say a big thank you to Laura for joining us to discuss complications of shingles. Thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website to find others on a variety of subjects. Goodbye.